should be getting smaller, more sustainable. And that's what you're seeing play out on the land right now.
And of course, that could have serious implications for these workers. What happens to them if Wonderful downsizes?
They lose their livelihood. Already mechanization is changing, you know, the labor situation. The citrus is still hand-picked, but all the nuts are machine-picked, and that's idled workers as well. So we're seeing a shift now. And then to have nature imposing its will on the situation.
Mark Arax is a journalist and author who wrote a piece about the Resniks and their wonderful company for California Sunday Magazine. It's really a stunning piece of writing. Mark, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
This final note, did you notice any unequal snacking at your Super Bowl party last night? Because apparently women don't like to crunch our chips loudly in public or lick our fingers. That's according to PepsiCo's female CEO, Indra Nooyi. She told Freakonomics Radio that the company is preparing to launch a line of women-friendly snacks like low-crunch chips with less stuff that sticks to your fingers. Okay.
Marketplace is supported by IARPA's Hybrid Forecasting Competition, where you can test and improve your global forecasting skills as a volunteer. Learn more at hybridforecasting.com. And by Baird, a financial partner guiding families, businesses, communities, and institutions since 1919. rwbaird.com has more information. And by Home Advisor, matching homeowners with background check professionals for home projects from minor repairs to major remodels. See homeowner reviews, compare prices, and book appointments at homeadvisor.com.
That's it. We got to go. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped 1,175 points, 4.6%. You heard that right. The NASDAQ fell 273 points, 3.75%, and the S&P 500 shed 113 points, 4.1%. And you can follow the market open tomorrow on Morning Report. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Sean McHenry, and Daisy Palacios. Our special projects desk includes Tommy Andres and Haley Hirschman. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our wealth and poverty desk. And I'm Amy Scott, in for Kai Rizdahl. I will see you tomorrow. This is APM.
Hi, this is Derek Lale, event supervisor at Centennial Hall with CBJ Parks and Recreation. Our team and I are looking forward to planning your event at Centennial Hall, Juneau's convention center located in the heart of downtown's Willoughby District. We offer a variety of equipment for rent, technical support, and room setup, and work with caterers to assist you in making your vision for the event come true. For more information, call 586-5283 or visit our website, centennialhall.net.
Hey folks, I'm Nick Spitzer with American Roots from New Orleans. Each week we travel the highways and byways for blues and jazz, roots rock and soul, Zydeco and Tejano, gospel, country, and more. So join me for the songs and stories from home and on the road on KRNN Juno 102.7. Music and arts for the capital city with American Roots. Tuesdays at 9 p.m.
Good evening. I'm Dr. Elaine Schroeder. Welcome to Mind Over Matter, a monthly K2 radio show that explores issues of the heart as well as of the mind. Lately, I've expanded the vision of our program to include societal issues that affect everyone's well-being. Tonight's program will look at restorative justice, which is an innovative and compassionate response to one of America's most pressing problems, that of mass incarceration. Restorative justice offers a more humane and effective approach to confronting the root causes of crime and the high rates of recidivism, that is, offenders returning to prison after they have served time. So with me in the studio tonight are two Junoites, K.J. Metcalf and Dr. Ray Pastorino. Both have studied and worked with the problems inherent in our current criminal justice system, and both are now advocates for an alternative process, that of restorative justice. So welcome, KJ and Ray.
Well, good to be here. Thank you, Elaine.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you so much for coming in. So I'd say most of our listeners are not exactly sure what restorative justice is or why people become involved with restorative justice. So let's start off with you, KJ. Could you please tell me a little bit about yourself and what led to your interest and involvement in restorative justice?
Well, for a number of years, I've worked with inmates and both in prison and those recently released, youth and adults who are affected by NFASD. That's where their mother drank during pregnancy.
Fetal alcohol.
And so they have somewhere on the spectrum of fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, which means that they have a brain disability that is lifelong, and there are coping skills that they can learn that help them have a more successful life. But they really need an external brain to coach them. They forget consequences. They have trouble understanding what got them in jail in the first place, and they go right back and repeat the same offense and not understanding that it's going to land them back in jail. As an example, I had one young man, when you compare to myself, but he was in his – he's now in his mid-40s, and he's a local Junoite, and he's been arrested something like 45 times. And when I'd appear with him in court and help him through the court process, the DA would bring out a big stack of his records and hold it up for the judge. And I even had his public defender, his defense attorney, tell me that he deserves jail time. And my response was, well, has it worked?
Why repeat something that doesn't work?
Yeah, so it seems that our jails over the years have evolved into the default care system for people who have disabilities and addictions. And it forced the building of new jails. It forced the contracting out to for-profit companies in Arizona and Colorado. Our inmates sending them away from home. So it's not a good system. There's some wonderful people in the corrections system who are the guards and administrator. But they have a terrible task, I think, in trying to manage inmates with their ever-diminishing funds and abilities to deal with the conflicts, and at the same time an ever-increasing prison population. So I was of the opinion that there just had to be a different way to deal with many of these inmates and the crimes. And I also noticed that oftentimes the victims were treated with disdain and with like they were part of the problem. And so I didn't see healing. I didn't see healing on the victim's part. I didn't see healing on the community's part nor on the perpetrator's part. So restorative justice requires you to take a totally different look at the system and look at who has been injured and how might they be healed. I'll let maybe Ray expand on that.
Well, Ray, okay, so now we know how you got involved, but we don't know how you got involved with FASD, and maybe that's too long a story.
Well, many of the inmates have an FASD.
So you got involved with with the prison system as a volunteer? Or
yeah,
how, KJ?
I worked a lot with youth and couldn't understand what was going on with some of the youth. And since FASD is a relatively new diagnosis in the mid-70s.
Mm-hmm.
And it took a while for it to become well-known. So living in a village in Juneau and in Anchorage, could see the population was well overrepresented by people of color,
yes.
Indigenous people, people of lower income. And so just trying to put those—
You mean the prison population.
Yeah, just yeah. trying to put those dots together kind of led me to find out what FASD was all about.
Yeah, and just to mention, I think, you know, you're definitely not in the social service field. Your career was with Forest Service, as I remember.
Right, and that also led me to a second career in environmental activism. And I got kind of worn out on that, and it was so hard to see progress, and I just was missing connection with people.
Yeah.
So I decided that I would change direction a little bit and work directly with people, kind of hands-on.
Yeah.
And I feel that, one, if you want to understand your community, you need to embrace conflict, and you need to kind of go to sometimes the dark places in the community to see what really goes on. And if anybody is been downtown around midnight, weeknight, and notice the homeless people on the streets, 20 or 30 or 40 people wandering up and down the streets. You know, there's a serious problem in the community. And those are some of the signs of the disconnect, but it's not the root causes. So I think we need to focus on what some of the root causes are. And the only way you can do that, in my case, is to kind of get involved with people
yeah.
and have relationships.
Yeah. Thanks, KJ. Ray, what brought you into this field? Now, I know you're a lawyer and a psychologist.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd say there's some clues there. How did you get involved?
Well, I like the last thing. Maybe this will be a segue, but I like the last thing KJ was saying about, you know, the calling for community responses to issues. Going out at night and just becoming aware of community issues. Because for me, restorative justice is really more about restoring communities and reflects a process change. 40 years ago, I was practicing law. I was also working as an administrative hearing officer. And through those experiences, I began to see that complex problems just didn't seem to always get addressed. And those people who had the issues were sort of hamstrung in the process. We tend to hand the problems that we have over to the state or to the court or to a lawyer or to some expert to take care of us. And it wasn't always very resolving.
You mean for the victim?
Well, for any conflict, let's say.
Oh, okay.
Okay, and we'll get to that with victims. But it wasn't very resolving. And so I started looking around at processes that seemed to be more – that seemed to empower the people that were embedded in dealing with those. And I looked at mediation processes. And at that time, people really weren't studying it from the perspective of, well, why does this work? They would look at the expert, the mediator –
mm-hmm.
or the discipline in which the mediator worked to see, well, what are they doing? But they didn't really ask the people why this works for you or how does it work for you? What's empowering about it? So
you mean it's just about mediation?
This was initially about mediation. So mm-hmm. I went back to school, worked on a master's, worked on a doctorate with a primary focus of what is it that makes this work, you know, from the user's perspective? What empowers them? What happens? What transforms them? And it really was about them being empowered to address an issue themselves, be supported in doing that face-to-face in a meaningful way. And what happened was something very, very transformative. Most of our processes are focused on juridical processes, are focused on win and lose, right or wrong. Mm-hmm. They're retributive, not restorative. And the people who participate in those processes don't even meet each other. Well, in these kids' processes of peer mediation, they were meeting each other. Uh-huh. And that ended up being when they could actually hear one another, listen to one another, through facilitation, of course, but by peers, something happened, something transformative. They were suddenly – they saw the other person. And for myself and for my wife, Alex, as well, who's worked a lot on this with me, that was the moment of change and shift and resolution. So in the years that have followed, I've worked in mediation and with other processes. But I've noted that in the last 30 to 40 years, there's been a movement towards process change where we're not dependent on the experts. We're really moving towards things that empower the actual users to solve their own problems.
When you say there's been a movement towards this new process or more collaborative process, are you thinking in the U.S.? Because I feel like it's going in the opposite direction.
Well, these things are quiet and they take decades. They take decades. We've had research about the power of collaboration and cooperation for 70 years, but we have all kinds of evidence that points to these things. But we are embedded in a system of positional win and lose. It's adversarial. It's we're going to struggle through this to find out who's right and wrong. But a process change is important. If you go back to mid-'80s to early 90s, you'll see an emergence, for example, from the Harvard that came in with the win-win negotiation techniques of principled negotiation. You had another book, Crucial Conversations and Difficult Conversations, also came from them. At the same time, Marshall Rosenberg was doing nonviolent communication across the country, in prisons, in foreign countries.
In Juneau. Well, not Marshall Rosenberg didn't come to Juneau, but we've had numerous nonviolent communication trainers.
Have come here to teach this. And in the business world, in addition to crucial conversations, they've also looked at emotional intelligence, client-centered interviewing, motivational interviewing, all with a mind towards establishing a relationship with the person that you're working with. And so restorative justice is really about involving all the stakeholders in whatever issue it is you're dealing with and involving them and empowering them. And when it comes to justice, then we have quite a few people that we can include that are not included right now.
You know, there's a startling and very sad example that has happened recently, and that is the trial of the gymnast physician who sexually abused dozens and dozens of young gymnasts. And the father of one of them jumped up in anger and started to attack the physician. And I thought when I saw that in the paper, I thought of you, and I thought of how desperately that father had needed to be part of the process as a family member of a victim. And he was just bursting with a need to express himself, and unfortunately it was violent. And I just thought how using, you know, that dramatic example, and of course in cases of sexual abuse, we may not find it therapeutic to have the victim in the same room, although they were in the same room. They were in the courtroom. His daughter testified. But it wasn't in a way that could at all allow the family members to become involved. Did that strike you at all? I don't know if you read
that. Well, for me, there's two parts to that. One is there needs to be a real emphasis and focus on making our problem-solving processes safe for those who participate in them. Mm-hmm. That means not just the judge and the lawyers, but it means everyone. If you ask anybody how they feel if they walk into a courtroom, they're scared to death.
Absolutely.
And so safety is really an important part. And then involving them early, that's a great example that you gave us of a person. All of the feelings and needs of that individual had been building and building and building. I don't know how long that trial or hearing went on, but that's a long time to not be involved.
Yeah, just to sit
in
back
a healing
watch.
Process, but yeah. To be pulled in at the very end, at the sentencing part of it. Restorative justice is really about getting where it's facilitated and made safe, people involved early on to start a healing process that's helpful.
So, yeah,
I was going to say that when a crime has been committed, even before maybe the person has been found who committed the crime, there's a need to take care of the victims and begin to minister to their needs. And you raised a good point. Maybe it's not possible to bring the perpetrator into the face-to-face with the victim, but there's also the possibility of having surrogates, someone who has done a similar crime but isn't the individual who all of the hate is focused on right there. But I think that one of the important things to think about in restorative justice is that the perpetrator needs to understand the harm that he or she has caused and needs to understand it in detail. And for that perpetrator to simply say, "I'm sorry," is a cop-out. They have to understand the hurt that they've caused in such a way that they can describe it back to the victim, even if it's not the actual person who did it, but someone who did a similar crime, in order to make it safe. And that's a big part of the restorative part. And it's been proven by evidence-based that people who go through these processes don't reoffend as nearly as often, and there's much greater healing that takes place between the victim, the perpetrator, and the community if they're all involved.
Now, I understand that restorative justice is not one size fits all. Could you, though, for me and for our listeners, give us a possible example of a process that you know of that has happened perhaps in our country or another country? Because we're talking about sort of a round table where people are at the table. Could you give us an example just so people can understand a little more concretely what we're talking about?
Well, I could describe an event that took place this last spring. Friends of Admiralty put together a cruise to Thunder Bay, to the internment camp where the folks from St. George and St. Paul were literally imprisoned and in harshest conditions, and there were it was a high rate of fatalities because of poor nutrition, no health considerations, and anybody wants to take a look at that. It's a fascinating story. But they were brought down from the Pribilofs and interned there. And so we put together, first of all, we had a session on Killisnoo Island next to Angoon, because that was also an internment camp. And we put a plaque up, and that was reported in the newspaper, and the prisoners, the prison inmate council at Lemon Creek, was moved by that story and decided that they would create two huge Russian crosses. They were 11 feet tall. They're massive crosses. And they were works of art done out of cedar and with carvings and paintings on it. It was just beautiful. And they wanted to donate these crosses to the internment camp sites as they called them healing crosses. And so the one cross that we took to Funter Bay seemed like the perfect opportunity to invite folks from the Aleutians down. Mm. So some of the actual internees who were youth at the time came down, plus their families. And the Fish and Wildlife was in charge of the camp because, to go back to what was going on the first seal haul-out grounds in the Aleutians, Fish and Wildlife was in charge of those, and the Aleuts were the labor for killing the seals, and the furs were an important part of a contribution to the national treasury. So it was an economic business, and the whole sealing effort depended on the local Aleuts. So that's why they were kind of in charge of the villages in that sense, certainly the economic portion of it. So they came down on the boat that brought the Aleuts down, and the conditions were horrible. They were in the Aleuts were stored in the hull of the boat. The administrative people had cabins upside. There was a doctor on the boat who refused to treat any of the Aleuts. A baby was born, and probably due to lack of treatment and any medical care, died, and they had to bury that baby at sea. And people died in the camps because they didn't have help. So there's a lot of anger and unresolved issues. And having spent 20 years in a federal agency, agencies don't like to say they did wrong. And it's very hard for them to ask for forgiveness. But the Fish and Wildlife and the woman who was in charge of the Alaska Fish and Wildlife Service, I had a chance to meet with her and talk to the Fish and Wildlife. Would it be possible for them to apologize on this trip? And they said, well, we don't apologize very well. We've got a lot of things that we need to apologize, but we don't do it very well. And so I gave them some research papers and kind of prepped them. And they came down and they did one of the most amazing jobs I have ever seen an agency do. After the Aleuts carried this beautiful cross that the inmates had created, and this, I have to take an aside here, the inmates were healing, got some healing out of building those crosses. They were, I talked to the project manager who was an inmate, and he said the hardest thing was to get them all to work together because they all hated each other. And prisons can be like that.
Sure.
But they produced these two beautiful crosses, and they felt that they had really contributed something to the community. The Aleuts came down and with their family, some who had never been to the site, and some of the younger people who were interned, of course, they're much older now, but they could talk about what it was like and the hardships that they went through and how their parents suffered so that they could have food and clothing. And so at the end of this trip, the Fish and Wildlife got up and talked in detail about the wrongs that they had done to these people. And it was amazing.
Amazing. And it's amazing that this could be done in the lifetime of camp survivors.
Right.
Because if we had waited, you know, another decade.
And the interesting thing, we've done several of these trips, not exactly like this, but usually on the way back, it's been a long day and people are sleeping and kind of coming down. But That boat was so full of energy. There were people talking, laughing. There were people who said, I feel so much better that my kids can see and understand what I've been talking about for years.
Yes. Oh, fantastic. Ray, were you going to say something?
Well, that's a great example of, you just mentioned it, something that spans a whole lifetime being finally given voice to, in contrast to the example you just gave a little while ago about the father of one of the gymnasts.
In the courts.
In just the span of the generational issues are huge, and we have lots of great examples.
The Pribilof Island genocide, I'll call it, aren't they doing something similar? Well, in Canada, isn't there a kind of truth and reconciliation process going on around First Nations boarding schools?
Right, yeah. They've taken that on as a national discussion. And I talked to some of my friends in Canada, and because they seem to be more prone to search out truth and reconciliation and restorative practices and healing in a whole bunch of different areas that I think we could learn from. And they treat their indigenous people differently than we do, because the indigenous people have some rights that are encapsulated in their federal constitution. And so it's not policy that they engage the First Nation people. It's part of their constitutional rights.
Mm.
And so they have a much stronger voice in many of their decisions than we allow in the United States.
Okay. So we're talking about, shall we say, extra legal types of restorative practices, restorative justice practices, mm-hmm. that are not part of the criminal justice system. So that's an example. Do you have any example of any other culture, any other place, or even in the U.S., where people have sat around the table, where there is a inclusion of this restorative process?
In our local schools.
In the criminal justice system.
There's therapeutic court here, which is an effort. Judge Kirsten Stewart?
Swanson.
Therapeutic court is one effort. Tribal courts, I think, try to lean it more in the restorative direction. I think we were chatting just the other day about the alternative school tries to use restorative practices for discipline.
Mm-hmm.
So those are three examples. Each community is going to be a little different in what it takes on or chooses to, but those are more local examples. Maybe KJ has other examples.
Yeah, there's another one, and that's the Success Inside and Out, which occurs every year at Lemon Creek. And it's started actually in Highland Mountain Prison for Women in Eagle River, where it brings the prisoners who have a year or so left to serve. And the community comes in and they work together to understand such simple things as, how do you get your credit back? Mm-hmm. How do you get your family back? Mm-hmm. How do you stay sober? How do you take care of your mind and your body? And it's an expression of the community interacting with the inmates. And housing and jobs are a huge part of it.
Yeah.
So one of the things is to have employers there, or at least them listed, saying, I will hire a felon. And there's some things I require, but I will not reject a qualified person just because they have a felony record.
Yeah.
And I work, like today, I worked a couple of hours on just trying to get a couple of folks who are living on the streets to keep them, first one from not becoming homeless and another one who's homeless to try and get him into a housing situation. And it's time-consuming, and Juneau is a tough, tough place to have. Well, look at what the temperature's been.
Yeah, I mean, it's been really rough. Mm-hmm.
You don't have to go very far to see people sleeping on the streets and in doorways.
Yeah. What about the warming center? Can you bring them to the warming center? But that's really brief, isn't it? It's like from 11
and that's
to
helpful.
P.m. Yeah.
That's a great use of space. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of an emergency. When the temperature drops so low, then they open it.
Well, you know, obviously there's more scope to have a restorative process outside the American court system. But let's really take a look at how our current system is in crisis. We have the highest per capita incarceration rate in the world. Mm-hmm. And this is shameful. And there is a disproportionate number of people of color, and certainly in Alaskan prisons of Native Alaskan Native people. And we have 724 people per 100,000, and let's – in prison, okay? We're way – I took a look at the statistics today, and you go from the other countries, and then there's this huge jump. So England has – we're set 724, okay, per 100,000. England is 145 per 100,000, and they're in the middle. So look at the – they're in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
And what do you think Norway is?
They have to be at the bottom.
75.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Compared to our 724. And let's take a look at recidivism rates. We've got one of the highest recidivism rates in the world. 77% of former offenders were arrested within 5 years after leaving prison. Norway, 20%. First of all, they have hardly anybody in jail, and then only 20% of those. So obviously it's the worst offenders that are in jail, and then 20%.
Mm-hmm.
Compared to our 77% of people who are in there from anything from minor drug offenses. And I will also mention prostitution, which is absurd, because I conducted my dissertation research on adolescent prostitution. And the reason I chose that topic is I was hired at Seattle's juvenile jail to work in the girls' unit as a counselor. And a high percentage of those girls were in for prostitution or petty crimes, and 99.5% of them, in my estimation, were there because they were being sexually abused, physically abused, neglected, in very, very harmful family situations, so they ran away to save themselves. So this really brings into view who is in prison and what's their deep story. Why are they in jail? What's going on? And I can see Ray's going to respond to that.
Well, those are the deeper sociological stories that don't necessarily make it into the retributive process. But they're absolutely present. So when you look at other countries like Norway and some of the other European countries – they are investing their time and money into restoration, into reentry, into retraining, into, like KJ was saying, direct, total confrontation, understanding of what has gone wrong here and what's needed to occur in the future. Restorative processes involve not just the offenders, but the victims, the offenders' families, the victims' families, and relevant members of the community. They're all involved.
Could you give a possible picture? I picture everybody sitting around a table now.
Okay.
So give me
some idea. All right. So one of the things that the folks that train others for restorative justice, facilitators for restorative community or restorative justice programs, they use a circle process, very indigenous, Native mm-hmm. American. Mm-hmm. They use talking circles. They use that as a way of bringing the stakeholders mm-hmm. into a meeting. So I can give you a simple example.
Okay.
Of moving from the higher end, which we've seen in some of the reconciliation processes in South Africa or Ireland or elsewhere where violence has occurred, to something real simple. One of the practice examples we used, which I know was a real example, was a circle process that we participated in as participants around a neighborhood issue where a New Year's Eve party was being held. It was an annual affair held at a different house every year in this community in Minneapolis, in this neighborhood in Minneapolis. And one of the teenagers stole a bottle of booze. And so it was about the theft of some booze because it was unclear how it ultimately came out into the open. But this child, this youngster was brought in, and authorities were involved. But they used a circle process for this. Facilitators met with the adult that whose house the party had been at that year. They met with other neighbors. They met with the teenager. And all of them then met in a circle process. And the facilitators helped everyone to talk about what they felt, what they needed, what they were struggling with, what the issues were. And anybody could participate in this process. And it was very, very interesting to me because it provided an opportunity for the adult victim, so to speak, to discuss how his trust had been shaken and how difficult it was going to be for him to trust having kids at other parties. It was the child was the youngster was able to express their remorse and what they felt about it, and also to discuss the kinds of peer pressures they were undergoing in the community from other teens around drinking and alcohol. Another individual community or neighborhood person was able to speak about, well, this had given them pause to think about the effects of having a party with a lot of alcohol and the effect that might have on other kids in the neighborhood. If they had not had this discussion, members of that neighborhood would have also begun to distrust this kid, labeled them for being a thief or whatever, or alcohol user, a problem child. But with this process, multiple people were empowered to discuss these issues that frequently aren't addressed or discussed.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So that's just a simple example.
Thank you. Thank you. And out there, if you are just joining us, this is Elaine Schroeder, and you're listening to a program on K2, Mind Over Matter. And I'm in the studio with KJ Metcalf and Ray Pastorino, and we are talking about restorative justice. And in a moment, we are going to have a little music, and then we will be right back to talk some more about restorative justice within the judicial system. And as Ray just explained, cases outside of formal judicial processes. We'll be right back.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Mind Over Matter. I'm Dr. Elaine Schroeder, and with me in the studio tonight is KJ Metcalf and Ray Pastorino, both from Juno, and we have been talking about restorative justice. So, we don't have a lot of time left, and I would like to know what you think is the real essence of restorative justice, how you see it working. Who wants to go?
Alex, Ray's wife, helped us with a camp where we had kids who were at risk. And she coached and helped the kids understand the restorative peer mediation. When somebody gets hit, when there's an argument, the kids learn to begin to resolve this themselves by deeply listening to each other and finding out what the cause was. And oftentimes kids can pick this up, and Ray can speak to this because he's worked so much with kids, and they can teach adults so much about peer mediation and restoring faith and connections, and that can carry on to a much broader stage of many of our systems.
Well, you know, I keep getting triggered with, this sounds like good parenting. I mean, and in this way, if your child does something that harms somebody else, a very effective thing to do is to bring together the child and the person who he's harmed. And in the case, our case, one of our children, while our boat was in Tanaki, when they were young, went into the Tanaki General Store and stole some small little fishing bobbers, which we discovered as we were about to pull out of Tanaki in our boat. And we stopped the boat, went back to the dock, and brought the little one in to the store. And much to their displeasure, they didn't want to do this. We coached them on how to say, I'm sorry. And that particular child never stole again. Not that it was a miracle, but it was just common sense that we brought the child to see the harm that they had done and meet the person that they had harmed, the store owner.
Great example. Our current justice system, to a large extent, is structured around what law's been broken, who did it, and what do they deserve kind of thing.
Yeah.
And that's how we're set up. But like KJ says, kids do this, and he's witnessed and observed this, and I have too. Kids do this so much better because they naturally seek out mediators. They are figuring things out. And so they move into doing it really well. That doesn't mean we're going to get rid of conflict. A certain amount of it's going to happen anyway. That's what we learn from. But it's important to change our process around how we address it. So some of the questions we can ask ourselves are, how do we know if restoration is happening? Well, are the needs of those harmed being met? Are they included in the process? Have they been heard? Have their needs been put on the table and addressed?
Mm-hmm.
Are we having a discussion about it? Is the person who has committed some offense, have they actually have they learned anything, or in terms of understanding what has happened, and have we learned anything about them in terms of what their needs may have been that have led them to this? Because this is this social problem, tip of the iceberg that we have. Others may have been affected as well by some offense. Are they included in the process?
Mm-hmm. Well, the whole community, when there's a rash of burglaries, for example, the whole neighborhood is impacted. What's going around Juneau right now, and I've heard this said many a time, I've never locked my house until now. Mm-hmm. In fact, we had literally lost our keys until the break-in for the OxyContin that occurred a couple of years ago, and then we started locking up.
And I'm sure, Elaine, that that was an unsolved crime, perhaps. And you can think about this. We were talking about people having voices or victims and restoration for them or addressing what their needs are. How many crimes are never solved? Well, there are all these victims of these crimes that are never addressed.
And how would restorative justice relate to that?
As a community, as conscious thinking people, we would begin to sit down and consider and think about how we might address that together, how we might help one another out, how we might do those things.
Mm-hmm.
There are – right now we seem to – there are many really well-meaning groups of people concerned about issues for others in this community. And in Minneapolis, where Alex and I received some training, they had a monthly meeting called Coming to the Table, a facilitated meeting for interest groups and individuals to come in to discuss a theme and how it could be addressed in the community and to generate interest, energy, and enthusiasm for various responses.
And in some ways, didn't we have that several months ago when there was – I don't know if we had a roundtable that people actually came together, but it was about homeless people sleeping in the doorways downtown. There was quite a dialogue going on in the newspaper for sure. Mm-hmm. And – you know, was a community issue. Should this be criminalized? And do you think that the warming center might have been a response to that?
Oh, I'm sure it is.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I was thinking of that too. Mm-hmm. Because it was, you know, many people wrote into letters to the editor or maybe spoke at the assembly that this was harsh because these people have nowhere to go. And obviously, if you're in a little crook of a doorway, it's a lot warmer than if you're just out on the street.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and yet the storekeepers, you know, their side of the story is equally poignant because look, you know, it was scary for people to open their shops. It was untidy. It may have hurt business. It was a tough community dialogue. I don't know if it was ever formalized.
Well, it was in the addressed in the campaign ordinance, but it didn't really solve the root problem. It took care of some of the immediate concerns of the store owners and the business community. I mean, it was unsanitary. It was driving business away, and it was, you know, it's a big problem.
Yeah.
I was going to say that I was heartened to hear that the Juneau School District has incorporated restorative mediation as an important part of the curriculum. They've blended it into the school system, and Yakutsk, for one, is evidently making great strides in that. And if we can get the kids to be thinking of a different model than the one we've taught for so many years, we'll find that as they become adults and decision makers that maybe the restorative justice model will be much easier to create.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This isn't easy. it's difficult. Most people's settings are for right and wrong and to take one side of a position or another. Bringing these different groups of people together, whether it's the homeless people and business owners, to have a very, very difficult discussion and be able to really listen. It's not easy, but it's important to do it.
And we didn't we don't need to reinvent the wheel. Mm-hmm. When I was a Peace Corps volunteer in a village in India, the traditional process was for the headman of the village to hold a council. And then people would come and voice their concern, you know, like Ram Dial stole my goat, or whatever it may be. Now, I can't attest to the fairness of that, because obviously you've empowered one individual. But the protagonists were there. I mean, the person who was accused and the person who was aggrieved. And so, and other village members were there. So it more resembled, I think, what you were talking about, because there was a dialogue and everybody was present in the room. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Ray could talk about the statistics of a school, kids that went to the principal.
Oh, yeah. The school where I conducted my research, it was interesting. When they the year before they this was a school of 2,000, 21 different cultures in this school. It was a high school.
Where was it?
In Contra Costa County in California.
Okay.
Concord High School. And there were over 2,000 kids. Before the year before they did all the training for the kids to develop peer mediators, they had 780-some conflicts, all sent to the principal or assistant principals. So this is a lot of administrative time.
Yeah.
And after a year of having peer mediators with their own office to handle all the conflicts that would come in, save thefts and assaults, the number dropped to 500 in that second year. In the third year, the next year of measurement, it dropped to about 265.
Mm-hmm.
And then it held steady at about 265, right in that area. So what they had is about a two-thirds reduction in the volume of conflict by implementing this kind of a program.
Wow. And are there programs that can't – like manuals where schools can invite a peer mediator trainer to come in and teach this process, I presume?
There's plenty of training involved. It's just – administrators, supervisors, principals, whether it's a business, they have to be willing to commit the time to allow those processes to happen.
Okay. Well, that's a wonderful note to end on tonight. And I want to thank both of you, Dr. Ray Pastorino and KJ Metcalf, for your enthusiasm and dedication to restorative justice in its many forms. And it is a totally new, to some of us, way to address social problems and create safer communities. So I'd also like to thank Jeff Brown, sitting over here, who has for so many years deftly operated the technology that makes this show happen, as well as Jeff has provided consistent encouragement for my efforts on this program. So I really want to thank Jeff. And, of course, I want to thank our listeners for tuning in. So this is a monthly show, once a month. So please join us for another edition of Mind Over Matter on another Monday evening next month. Good night. Thank you.
like the restaurant business. Many of the lowest paid employees are women, and those women face the brunt of workplace sexual harassment.
They suffer from 3 times the poverty rate and the highest rates of sexual harassment in the industry because they must put up with all kinds of inappropriate customer behavior.
Trying to help low paid employees address sexual harassment. Tomorrow on Morning Edition.
Every weekday at 4 a.m. on KTOO Juneau 104.3.